So please, you probably have to approve that at your end. I'm also going to put my camera on spotlight, which means that for a minute, it's going to jump to speaker view and my camera. You can turn it back to gallery view, but I need to do that for the video. So I'm going to put it on spotlight and now go back to gallery.
Yeah, but can I just mention one thing to you? You were talking about OWL 1 week.
Yeah.
And I got a thing because I contribute to U City Library every year. Mm-hmm. U City Library has an OWL. So you may want to speak to Patrick there about it.
Patrick's absolutely. That would be Patrick's amazing. Patrick's
the head of the library. You can even mention my name because I deliver library books to shut-ins. But I got a letter and the money that we all contribute, part of it went to an OWL. So just mentioned that U City Library has one.
Will they lend it out?
I have no idea. I'm thinking no, but you can find out.
I will ask them. I mean, I
don't think they'll lend it out though.
We can invest in one, but I don't want to do that until I've actually tried it.
Well, that's what I'm saying is maybe if you can speak to Patrick, you can set up something where you can try it.
Right. Okay. Very good. All right. Welcome all aboard.
I have to apologize because I'm going to have to click off the video. Okay.
No problem at all.
Prime cooking time on the East Coast. I mean, West. Yeah, East Coast.
You've got East Coast, West Coast, North Coast, South Coast.
Yeah, where I am today.
We've got everything. We've got everybody except Israel here. But yeah, so my parents are on the call too. So you can give them a shout out.
So
leave it. It's all good. Okay, well, welcome back. I see we almost a full house, so I appreciate everybody coming and participating. I am going to temporarily put everybody on mute, so please don't, as they say, don't take it personally. It's just going to mute all the computers, but you still can unmute at any time just to kind of chime in, participate, and join the conversation if you are able to. Leave your cameras on. It's helpful to me to kind of see faces, but I also understand if that's not possible. So that is your call. And I'm going to share screen. And that is where we are at. I do believe. Can everybody see the source page screen? Yes? Give me a...
Yes, David.
Yes, excellent. Okay. Anyway, that's not good. What happened to my second? Oh, 1 second. That's not good. Okay, that looks better. Okay. So we were, wrong tab. We've gone through this perek now once or twice just to kind of familiarize ourselves with the story itself. If you are joining us tonight for the first time, then I would just suggest to you to do a quick read either tonight or between now and next week. Of chapter 13 of Shmuel Bet. It's not an easy chapter to read. It's a very harsh chapter and a very hard story. We're going to kind of try to break it down, but it will help kind of bring everybody up to the same, onto the same page. Where we had left off was a question, which was to put it simply, what was Yonadav thinking? More or less, it's basically the question that we asked, meaning that we have this tension. We have the story of Amnon, and which is clearly an evil story. Amnon, who is lusting for his sister, half sister, stepsister, Tamar, whatever context we spent the good time amount of time last week trying to figure out exactly what that relationship was and who Tamar was, suggesting maybe even that she was a kind of a stepsister because she had been kind of came into the household from her mother, Ma'acha, Avshalom's mother, but Avshalom is the child of Ma'acha and David, and whereas Tamar may not be, and that was based on the possibility that Tamar and Amnon could theoretically be permissible to each other. But Amnon, of course, doesn't take that approach. He, in fact, I'm going to actually stop sharing for a second. He, in fact, goes and yearns for her, desires her, ultimately finds himself, orchestrates a time to be alone with her. And then instead of inviting her, whatever the circumstances are, he actually attacks her, he rapes her, and she runs out ashamed. And Avshalom hears about it, and Avshalom, who is her brother and sort of Amnon's half-brother, David doesn't do anything about it because he can't, especially in the aftermath of the story of Bathsheba. And so he takes the matters into his own hands. He waits 2 years, and he has he ambushes Amnon, kills him, and then flees the kingdom. More or less, on one foot, that's the sketch of the story. But the initial part of the story that bothered us at the end of the shiur was the suggestion of Yonadav, because it is Yonadav, David's nephew, Amnon's first cousin, who is described as a re'ah, as a friend of Amnon, who sees him, comes to him, and who ultimately suggests a little bit of this ruse that that Amnon should feign illness and that he should invite, convince David to send Tamar to him. And ultimately the question is, before we get into the second half of the story, I really want to start with understanding Yonadav. Was Yonadav complicit in this action? Or is Yonadav kind of an innocent bystander, or not so innocent? Who and what is Yonadav, and where is his part in the story? And that really starts with, let me just pull this back up. It starts with the phrase, V'yomer lo Yonadav, Ulamnon re'o shmo Yonadav ben Shim'a achi David, V'yonadav ish chacham me'od. It starts with this description of Yonadav as a very wise man, ish chacham. Rashi, and therefore the translation here, translates chacham as cunning, because anticipating that there is a kind of a negative to Yonadav's behavior. I shared with you last week the source, the various sources on this. If we look in the Mikra Okdalot, so Rashi says ish chacham l'rish'ah, right, an evil. Similarly, other Mefarshim make a similar comment. On the other hand, the Malbim suggests, actually, for some reason, the Malbim is only showing up partially. But the Malbim, I don't have it here, suggests that Yonadav is, that the word chacham can be good or bad. And in this case, his chokhmah is a positive description. And that requires us to understand a little bit more as to what Yonadav's suggestion is. And so what I'd like to do is try to reread the story from the vantage point of Yonadav and his conversation with Amnon. What is driving Amnon's angst? And what does Yonadav see? And what does he suggest as a solution? And is Yonadav, in a sense, the ultimate question is, what was Yonadav's intention? Is his intention in some way nefarious, as was Amnon's, or otherwise? And how does that play out? On the face of it, it would seem that Yonadav feels almost as betrayed as anybody else, because whereas in the beginning of the story, he's described here as a friend of Amnon, Amnon Rea, as a friend, which means that there's a relationship, there's a closeness, there's a connection. And yet at the end of the story, when David is looking out the window, I'm just going to jump, forgive me for scrolling quickly because it kind of makes you dizzy. But as you jump to the end of the story, when David is kind of looking out the window and anticipating that all that this ambush that Avshalom has orchestrated against Amnon has actually been an ambush of the entire royal family. That's the fear. That's what the rumor was, that all of the children of the king were killed. And so Yonadav's response is, Yonadav is sitting there. This, the next time he's mentioned, Yonadav ben Shima, Achid David, Yonadav ben Shima, who is David's nephew, says to David, Vayomer, Al Yomar Adoni et kol ha-ne'arim ben ha-melech hamitu. Don't think, don't say that he killed all of the children of the king. Ki Amnon levadomet. He is only killed Amnon. That's all. Avshalom, I'm sure it's only a matter of Avshalom having ambushed Amnon. I'm sure he had nothing no harm to any of the other Bnei Melech. But why would he want to kill Amnon? Ki api Avshalom itasuma miyom anoto tamarchoto. Avshalom had this intention to kill Amnon since he raped his sister. So Tamar, so certainly this is just about Avshalom exacting revenge on Amnon, and therefore there's nothing to remorse, there's nothing to regret. Don't pay any attention to it. Don't think that Kol Bnei Melech Metu. No, it's only Amnon. Only Amnon. And therefore, Amnon's not worth much. You know, Amnon is no great loss. Amnon, good riddance to him. You get a sense from Yonadav's response to David that Yonadav is as angry and as betrayed and feels animosity or anger towards Amnon as much as Avshalom and as much as anybody else. He kind of has this very cold response, even to the death of Amnon, certainly to his report to David. He could be playing the game, it's possible. But if I go back to the beginning of the story, when he's described as a rea, chacham, as a friend, and now suddenly to have this end of the story, to have such a harsh description, that is something which requires a deeper analysis. So our goal tonight is to begin to understand Yonadav, and what I would like to do in the time that we have is present one possible reading of the story and share that with you this evening, and a alternative reading of the story, Bezrat Hashem, next week. Because I think that there are really two ways to go in this perek, and while I have a bias, I'll try not to not to bias the presentation too much. But okay, let's go back to the beginning.
Why is Amadan described as David's brother's wife, son, and in the end, in the beginning and at the end?
Because that's his connections. Most of the members of David's inner circle are family members. Ibn Tsruya is David's sister, Yonadab ben Shima is David's brother. David HaMelech is surrounded by an inner core of advisors who are part of his extended family. And so that's not atypical. We'll see much more of that at sort of the very end of the Sefer in the review of all of the Giborim, all of the kind of warriors for David. But in this particular story, this is a very familial story, meaning it's all about the household of David. It's about Amnon and Avshalom, two sons of David. It's about Tamar, an adopted daughter, whatever that relation is. It's about Yonadav, who is a nephew, first cousin to Amnon and Avshalom. So everybody in this story is in some way connected to the royal family. I don't think that's surprising, nor do I think it's an accident. The story is about the family. So I think it's particularly significant. Now, off the top of my head, and I can't confirm this without doing a search, but off the top of my head, I don't think Yonadav appears. Sorry, I'm just going to turn that off. I don't think Yonadav appears anywhere else in Sefer Shmuel, meaning I don't think he plays a significant role. I have to check a little bit later in the story of the rebellion, because there's a lot of names and a lot of players in the story of the rebellion. But as far as I recall, it doesn't play a significant role beyond this parak, because it's really an internal matter within the family of David. And sort of you see the players here are very much part of the family. So let's go back to the beginning of the parak. Vayiach Rechein ulav Shalom ben David achot yafa ushmat Tamar vayaveh Amnon ben David. The basic core of this approach is going to start with the question of what's the driving variable in this parak? What's the driving issue here in this parak? And from the opening pasuk, there are two words that jump off the page that say to us, this is about X. So what is this about? What two words in this parak are really extraordinary, not atypical for a classic parak in, say, Sefer Shmuel or classic parak in Tanakh? One is, yeah, Robbie, did you want to say something?
Oh, I don't know. It sounds like it's leading to a sex story. She's fair. She's described as fair.
And the two, right. Go ahead.
So, you know, in the sentences, it's David had a fair, the son of David had a fair sister, and Amnon, son of David, loved her.
Right. There's two very powerful, emotionally laden words here that are not typical or not casual words in Tanakh. One is to describe Tamar's beauty. Ulav Shalom ben David achot yafa ushmat Tamar, not just an achot, but achot yafa, somebody who is beautiful. And the moment I describe her as beautiful, suddenly I enter into a series of stories in Tanakh in which there is somebody who is described as beautiful. Sometimes that is a positive description, and sometimes it's a dangerous description. Right? So you have Yosef, who's described as Yefetoa, right? Yosef is very beautiful. Gets him into trouble. It's not necessarily reserved for male-female issue. It's just a phraseology that is described that subjective, but it can be understood in a positive context, understood in a dangerous context. Abraham and Sarah and Parsha of Lech Lecha, right? Sarah is very beautiful, and suddenly Abraham has to realize that that puts a certain danger as they go traveling through the world in parts of the world where that could be potentially a source of danger. And he deals with it, and there's whatever that story means, but that's part of the lead up to that recognition. Similarly, that kind of description of Achot Yafa. And so the question becomes here, what is the significance of describing Tamar as beautiful? The answer is that it leads to Amnon's love for her, right? There's a response to her. There's a desire. There's a relationship. There's an emotion here. Vayaveh Amnon ben David. Now, that too in and of itself isn't necessarily a bad thing. There are many times in Tanakh where we have stories of connection between a man and a woman, and a man who loves his a woman and has a relationship with her and what marries her. Yitzchak is described as having loved Rivka and brought her into his tent, and that is perfectly normal and healthy and accepted. You have, and in general in Tanakh, the term ahava reflects not necessarily even a male-female context. You have, for example, the relationship between David and Yonatan, Ben Shaul, who's very close and very, you know, there's a bond there. And on the face of it, that could be very pure. But we know the end result. We know the end of the story. We know that this isn't about a romantic connection, romantic feelings that he has for her, but rather a function of or reflection of his desire, his passions, using a contemporary term, his lust for her, rather than his love for her. And we know that because we, the reader, are smart enough to know the end of the story. So we know that once they get alone together, he will turn all of that love into an act of violence. And then, most importantly, for our purposes, because we know how the story ends, we know what happens in Pasuk Tetvav, which is Vayisna'eha Amnon Sin'ah Gdola Me'od Ki Gdola HaSin'ah Asher Sne'ah Me'ahava Asher Aheva. Amnon, after he violates her, Amnon turns all of that love into hatred, which tells me retroactively that we weren't talking about an emotional connection, but rather a physical drive, a passion, a lust, and very dangerous, very nefarious kind of drive and relationship with her. And he throws her out. So that tells me right from the outset, I have two words that tell me that the center around which this story is going to revolve is the desire Amnon has for Tamar. And ultimately, the question is that a innocent desire? Two people, young people, single people who technically are allowed to marry, although it's sort of odd because they're stepsister and brother, but nonetheless, he loves her and he has relation and he has desire for her. Or is it a much more negative, dangerous kind of lust for her? Ultimately, that'll revolve around the question of who or what kind of person is Amnon. And we don't know that yet, because we, as this part of reading just Perek Aleph, we don't yet know how the story unfolds. We do know, however, that Amnon's love for her at this point is unresolved. Vayetzer le'Amnon lehitchalot. He was so distressed, he felt sick. Chalot, from the word chole. He was lovesick for Tamar Achoto. Again, we can interpret that differently. But ki bitulahi vayipale b'nei Amnon lasot lama'uma, for she was a virgin and it seemed too difficult to remove to Amnon to do anything to her, meaning that she was considered in his mind unreachable, untouchable. There was no way to pursue this romance with her because she was young, unmarried, virgin, and therefore she wasn't interested. To put it into contemporary terminology, she wasn't interested. And therefore, Amnon is allowed all of this passion to eat him up from the inside. And love sickness is a real thing. And ultimately comes along Amnon's friend, Yonadav, Ish Chacham Me'od. And that's where Yonadav enters the picture. It's fascinating, just to make a point on this Pasuk Bet, that the story begins in almost a striking contrast to the story of David and Bathsheba. Because David and Bathsheba's story that also began with a drive or a passion between two people whose relationship together would have been suspect and questionable, and ultimately happened, and then becomes the question of what he where it goes from there. And so much of the story kind of challenges us to compare and contrast to David and Bathsheba, both in the negative and in the positive. Ultimately, the end result of this parak is very different from the end result of the story of Bathsheba, and that too is part of our study. Bayomalo, Yonadab comes to Amnon, and this is where you begin to see his chokhmah, his wisdom. And that's essentially what the Malbim argues. Again, let me just repeat what I said at the outset. There are essentially two ways to look at Yonadav. There are those, Rashi, Mitzvah David, and others who look at Yonadav as a cunning, evil person, complicit to Amnon's desire and orchestrates the whole thing. The Malbim and others take the approach that he is a chacham in a positive sense. And what I want to present both tonight and next week are various variations of how to understand Yonadav in a somewhat positive context, right? Borrowing from the Malbim's approach and taking that through the text. Again, we could take a step back and say, Yonadav, first cousin to Amnon in every way, and leave it at that. And then this Chacham becomes very cunning. Whereas what the Malbim is suggesting is Ish Chacham Me'od is reserved for somebody who has a very positive outlook. He says to Amnon, Madua ata kacha dal ben hamelech baboker baboker? Son of the king, you are leaner every morning. Every time I see you, you become thinner and thinner. You're not eating, you're not sleeping. You look terrible, you look pale, you look sick. Tagidli, what is going on with you? And says the Malbim, that moment where he recognized in Amnon that something wasn't right is in itself an element of chokhmah. It takes a certain amount of wisdom and insight to be able to see that kind of complexion change, etc. But Amnon says to him, "Et Tamar achot Avshalom achi ani ohev." And there you have it. In this kind of a nutshell, I have romantically fallen for somebody who is essentially unreachable, untouchable. I have fallen for a sister of Avshalom, my brother. Tamar achot Avshalom achi ani ohev. And that says it all, because I can't do anything. I can't touch her. I can't say she's totally. What am I supposed to do now? Yonadav offers a suggestion. And he says the following. He says, look, you already look sick. You already look sick. I noticed that you're not well. You don't look well. You look thinner. You look leaner. You look like you're not eating. You look pale. You know what? Play the card. Play the role. Shchava mishkavcha. Lay on your bed, vihitchal, and pretend to be sick. You already look it. It's not going to take much for you to convince anybody that you are sick. And therefore, if you are in fact sick, people will come to Mevakacholim, they'll come to greet you, they'll come to see you, they'll come to offer you well, and who's going to come? Your father. Now, again, what is Yonadav's intention here in suggesting to Amnon to feign an illness that he doesn't have in order to bring his father to see him? What does he accomplish there? And I think he accomplishes at least two things, if not three.
Maybe, can I suggest something?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Maybe if he pretends he's that way, then his father will feel like he's a miskin, and he wants, and you know, he'll feel like he has compassion on him. So whatever he asks, then he'll be happy to do.
100%. I think there's a lot of part of Yonadav's chokhmah is the orchestra, is words and ideas that build a certain sympathy and empathy for Amnon. He's sick, pretending to be sick, actually sick. But who's going to come and see you? Your father. And because you are ill, of course they're going to assume that your intentions are pure, and that there's this sympathy, there's an empathy that's created by the circumstances around your father coming to see you. Well, absolutely. And the illness that you are complaining or representing the itchal v'avicha livotecha, it also kind of removes any potential thought of ill intent, because he's sick. He's just physically weak. So of course his intentions are not going to be nefarious or dark if he's not well. Right? So it kind of creates a certain amount of sympathy and identification with what is about to happen.
Maybe he pretends to be sick so your father will come to see you. Maybe right. King David hasn't come to see him in a long time.
Yeah, that is also impossible. Unclear why that is the case, but we will explore that as well in much more detail about Zat Hashem next week.
Rabbi,
you also
isn't,
know he, oh,
go ahead.
Isn't You know, what I'm trying to do is to get them together with no one else there, which they couldn't do under the circumstances.
So we're going to get to that in a second. Right. So we're going to get to that in a second. That is correct, but we're going to get to that in a second. Well, that's the second half of this verse. So once you have this sympathy and empathy created by this illness and your father's visit, then you'll say to him, Tavona Tamar Achoti, I am not feeling well. I need my sister to come and make dinner for me. V'tavreni lechem. Give me bread. I could use a really good bowl of Tamar's chicken soup. That's what I could use. Abba comes to see Avnon, my son, what can I do for you? So I'm not feeling well. I could really use Tamar, my sister's special recipe chicken soup. And I let her prepare the food. I'll watch and be able to eat from the creation of her hands, a special food that she will make for me. Vayishkav Amnon. Let me finish the next sentence and we'll come back to it. Vayishkav Amnon. So he does. He does exactly what Yonadav suggests. Vayitcha feigns this illness. Vayavo HaMelech Leroto. King comes to see him. Vayomer Amnon LaMelech. And Amnon says exactly as prescribed by Yonadav. Tavona Tamar Achoti Utzlabev Len Ashtei Levivot Vevram Yadeila. Sister, come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat of her hand. He repeats the instructions and shares with his father the desire to enjoy a dinner prepared for him by Tamar. So, in fact, so David goes home and he so instructs Tamar to go to his brother's house and prepare him some food for his health. And that is, for now, part one. The scene is set for Tamar to enter into Amnon's palace. So from the outset, it would seem on the first glance reading that Amnon and that Yonadav and Amnon have orchestrated a very simple plan to enable Tamar to come and prepare food for him. That's the pretense that will get them together. So my question at the outset is there any indication here so far that Yonadav and Amnon are heading in different directions? Or are they in sync in terms of what they are plotting or planning for Tamar to come and be alone with Amnon in order that he should be able to have a night with her? What is the thought? Is Yonadav and Amnon singing the same tune at this point, just here in Psukim Hey and Vav?
Yeah.
It would seem so. Okay, it would seem so. I'm just going to throw out the possibility that there's a nuance here that may already give us a foreshadowing of the fact that Amnon and Yonadav speak very different languages. And Yonadav, to the question, I think Joyce, somebody asked me the question why his family lineage here is identified, right? Why is he Ben Shimaa Be'achid David all the time? Yonadav is a royal. Yonadav grew up in the house, is a member of David's, it's the same generation of Amnon, but I think he comes from a very different place than Yonadav, than Amnon. Amnon is much more crude. And where you see that is in the language of the text. And I'm going to show you something. I'm just going to do a simple comparison of two phrases. So I'm going to jump to the source page for a second. These are the same two psukim. This is what I call Amnon, Yonadav's suggestion to Amnon. And this is Amnon's conversation with David. So we're just going to compare them. Your father will come to see you. It's exactly what happens. You will say to him, Amnon says to the king, Tavona Tamar Achoti, Tamar, my sister, come. That's exactly what Amnon says. Tavona Tamar Achoti. Up until this point, the invitation of Tamar to come to bring him food is identical in both accounts. But here's where there's a subtle nuance of a difference. The Tavreni Lechem, Yasta Le'enai et Tabiriya, let her prepare bread before me so that I may see and eat of her hand. Meaning, let her prepare food that I may consume. I'm sick. She makes wonderful food, wonderful bread, wonderful chicken soup. You know what? That would be really helpful to me. But Tavreni Lechem. In and of itself, that is a very innocuous and innocent expression. Amnon's rephrasing of that same request, however, carries with it a language that is a little more intense. Because instead of saying "Vatavreni lechem," what does he say? "Utilabev le'enai shtei levivot." Now, you could translate that in the same way. Let her make two cakes. But the word leviva is very different from the word lechem. So true, it means some sort of dish, bread, cake, some kind of food. But, and I'm not talking about the modern Hebrew word leviva, I'm talking about the biblical context of leviva, carries within it the phrase, the root of the word lev. And that already has a connotation that is much more intense. I'll give you an example. Listen to this phrase. Utlabev le'enai shtei levivot. Let her, how does it translate it? Make me a couple of cakes, two cakes. So first of all, he changes the number. Yonadav said nothing about the numbers, but Tavreni Lechem. You know, Amnon's suggestion, two levivot. Why two?
One for each one.
Right. One for each of them. In other words, suddenly it's not about having to make him food because he's sick. It's about them sharing
a meal.
Yeah, having a date.
Having a candlelight dinner.
Yeah.
Okay, now it's about sharing a candlelight dinner. There's a very different connotation, shtei levivot. The phrase itself, t'labev l'inai shtei levivot, should ring familiar if we listen very carefully to the davening on Shabbos Chol HaMoed Pesach. Because the phrase jumps off the page of Shir HaShirim. Take a look at Shir HaShirim, Perek Dalet, Pasuk Tet. Libavtini achoti kala, libavtini beachat me'enayich, beachat anak me'katzavonayich. Libavtini achoti kala, you have, again, even the translation is different. It's translated here as you have ravished my heart. You have made my heart, from the word lev or levav, hungry. Libavtini achoti kala, and again, achot. Tamar achoti, achoti kala, my sister, my bride. Right, the play on the words here is very intense. Libavtini bechat me'enayich. With one of your eyes, you have ravished me. How much emphasis is there on the eyes of Tamar, or his eyes on her? Right? Suddenly it's libavtini achoti kala, libavtini bechat me'enayich. Ravished my heart. That connotation, utlabev le'enai, my heart ravishes for her food, is very different than I would love a bowl of her chicken soup. My heart ravages to share a meal with her, is essentially what he says to David. My heart ravages to share a meal with her. Yonadav did not say that, because it's a language that's too crude for Yonadav, who's far more refined.
How could he say that to his father?
Oh, so that's powerful. He says it to his father, but look what his father does. Look what David does. David turns around. Vayishlach David al Tamar baita lemor lechina beit anon achich va'asilo habirya. Prepare him dinner. Which would fit the language of Yonadav. In other words, David doesn't even hear it. David takes the takeaway of it. David hears the language that Yonadav had suggested. David doesn't hear it, partially because David in this whole story is still dealing with the aftermath of the mourning of in the previous parak, and plays a very kind of secondary role. We'll talk about that as the parak unfolds. But certainly David does not hear this intention or this intensity. But the language here, I think, reflects the beginning of a distinction between Yonadav, or separation between Yonadav and Amnon. They're not operating on the same page.
But Yonadav also knew that it was a fake scenario. He knew he was faking it.
Correct. But for what purpose? But for what purpose?
To get his sister into the room, because he was in love with her. He was
correct
for her.
But so, that's different than planning to rape her. I want to put a context here for a second. This is very important to understand. And I'm going to say something which may sound a little bit crude, but just we're dealing with Tanakh. And so we need to be very clear in expectations. In the world of Tanakh, in the biblical context of the relationship between men and women, it's not at all clear that there is a prohibition against the act of sex between unmarried men and women if they are not forbidden relations. What we call sex out of wedlock, it's not at all clear that it is prohibited in a biblical level. Rabbinically, for sure. And there's even some discussion about whether or not it's biblically prohibited with a Gentile. That becomes part of the conversation with Pinchas and Moab, etc. But unmarried people, right, man and woman, assuming that there's no biblical prohibitions, assuming you address the issues of Tuma, etc., it's not at all clear that there's prohibited, which is partially why David and Bathsheba could happen in that context, and why that we talked about that last year a little bit. In other words, it's quite possible, especially if I remove the incest question, which we talked about last week, that Yonadav's intention was to get them alone together. For what purpose?
Get married.
Maybe not yet. Maybe not yet. But at least they should have a night together. Amnon has been saying all along. He's saying his desire is for Tamar, and Tamar is a betula, and therefore she won't touch him. She won't come near him. She won't have anything to do with him because she's still a virgin. I can't do anything. I can't act on this because it's too far removed. I can't even get her to be alone with me. So Yonadav says, okay, you know what? That's a problem or a challenge we can solve. But the goal here was to get them, according to this approach, was to get them alone together for, I would say, almost innocuous purposes. They should be together. Okay, that's terrible.
Is there any indication how old Tamar is?
No. No.
From what Yonadav heard, he's in love with her. So that makes sense. He's not in lust with her. He's in love with her.
Right.
So that almost makes sense.
And if that's his intention, his goal is whatever scenario he has constructed, the goal is to get them alone together. And that's it. After that, let nature take its course. He will make an offer to her. She'll accept. She'll not accept. Whatever that's between them. At this point, Yonadav's goal is to orchestrate a circumstance where they can, where she can find the door to his palace.
Wasn't it still up a bit until sketchy now, that...
Get him to get it through the door. At this point, does Yonadav anticipate that Amnon has the kind of intent, lust, and personality who could turn this innocent desire into an act of violence? I don't think so.
It seems like if he was really smart, like he might kind of be able to intuit that, because I mean, I think he makes a lot, that Amnon makes a lot of bad choices, and it seems like maybe, I don't know, that might have not been his first bad choice, but.
Is it possible that Yonadav has some pretensions to royalty himself?
And I don't believe so. There's way, trouble, I that don't, that's him... too Shakespearean for,
But wasn't their relationship already suspicious? Like, was it his sister? Was it his half-sister? Was it like...
Yeah, but that's only suspicious because we don't know that. That's only suspicious because we don't know all the facts.
We don't know. Right.
They would have known.
They will have a moon, and that's his advantage. He's pure, and they're not.
Yeah. So at the most, you could accuse Yonadav, I think, of being a little naive. Okay. I think at that point, that's probably the most you could say. On the other hand, and naivete is not a crime. On the other hand, I don't think he's even that naive. I think he is truly managing to kind of help his friend and cousin. And you know, I don't think anybody anticipated where this was gonna end up.
Maybe call him a romantic.
Maybe. All right. Which brings us to the heart of the story. Pardon the pun on the to Labev Lenaishte Levivot. Vatelech Tamar bat Bet Amnon Achia. She goes to her brother's house. Vuhu shochev, and he's lying in his bed. Vatikach ad batzek vatalos. She takes the dough. She kneads it. Vatelabev leinav vatvashalat levivot. She makes the cake in his sight. She bakes the cakes. Vatikach ad masret. She takes the pan. Vatitzok lefanav. She poured it out before him. You can see the extent to which the text describes the process of baking. Not typical. We don't usually describe the process of making, you know, the recipe for making this cake. You got to take the dough and you got to knead it and you got to cook it and you got to bake it. That's totally irrelevant, except that in this case, it's all part of, from Amnon's perspective, he's lying there watching her. And everybody else thinks it's very innocent. Vayomer Amnon, otziu kol ish mi'alai, remove everybody from here. I want to be alone. Vayetzu kol ish mi'alav, and they all leave. Vayomer Amnon el Tamar, havi habirya cheder. Okay, Tamar, bring the food here into my room. Ve'evra mi'adech, that I may eat of your hand. Let's, you made two portions, let's eat together. She takes the cake, she brings it into his bedroom, and everybody else is gone. Close the door, end the pasuk yud, and what do I have? I have Yonadav's plan come to fruition exactly as orchestrated. Amnon and Tamar alone together. That's what I have. Understand, at this point, they've done nothing wrong. Now, the only thing you could accuse them of, really, is a violation of Yichud. But Yichud here hasn't yet been decreed. Yichud is a rabbinic decree. Yichud as a gezerah has not yet been, you'll forgive the expression, hasn't been invented yet. In fact, the Gemara actually argues, and I'll share this with you on the source page, that... it's Gemara in Sanhedrin. Geder gadol gadrat Tamar b'otasha'a. In the aftermath of the story of Amnon and Tamar, there was a great fence established then, namely, And that moment, Gazrua Yichud Pnuya, they made a decree against the seclude, being alone, a man and an unmarried woman being alone together. That decree, says the Gemara, is directly related to the aftermath, as so many laws and decrees are. They sort of realize the loopholes and the concerns of the breaches and the fences that need to be mended. This was a breach and a fence that needed to be mended. But at this point, the only thing you could accuse them of, maybe, is that violation of a decree that hasn't yet been invented. She goes into a room, she closes the door behind them, she gives him his food. And at that point, everything that Yonadav had suggested has come to fruition. The moment Pasuk Yud Aleph begins, we are now into the intentions of Amnon, and I don't believe that Yonadav anticipated where this would go. Vategesh elav le'achol, she brought him the food, vayachazek ba, and he, who's supposed to be sick and weak, vayachazek ba, he grabbed her, vayomar la, he said to her, boy shechvi mi, lie with me, my sister, achoti, and here achoti means much more than just my sister. Right? How is the lover and beloved referred to in Shir HaShirim? Libaftini achoti kala. Achoti is this pun on my sister in the biological sense, or a half-sister, a stepsister, but also in a term of endearment for my love. Achoti kala. And her response, realizing exactly where this is going, she right away recognizes where this is going to go. Vayechazakba, he's grabbed her. And she begins her speech. And her speech is two psukim, and every word in her speech to him is filled with meaning and significance. First, Vatomalo, Al Achai, Achi. Number one, no. No, my brother. First, you're my brother. Right? You can call me your achot in the sense of my sister and also my lover or my bride or my beloved, but at the end of the day, we grew up in the palace together as siblings. Al achi, no, my brother. Al ta'aneini, do not force me. Sorry about that. That's what happens with this website. Hilo ye'asekem b'Yisrael, al taset nevelazo. This is not done in Israel. Do not do this shameful, disgraceful deed. This phrase she pulls not out of a hat, she pulls out of a perek. This is a phrase that should ring in our ears, because it's exactly the same phrase the Torah uses to describe what?
The rape of Dina.
The rape of Dina, exactly. A quick glance over Breishit Perek Lamed Dalet, Vatetze Dina Bat Leah Sheyelda LeYaakov, Vayarota Shechem Ben Chamor, Shechem Ben Chamor sees her, and Vayikach Ota, he takes her, Vayishkav Ota, Vayeaneha, he lay with her, he violated her, exactly the same language. The difference between Shechem Ben Chamor and Amnon, on the other hand, and we'll talk about this Bezat Hashem next, a shir or two from now, is Vatidbak Nafsho Bedina, is Vayehavet Nara, is for Shechem, he takes her, violates her, but then he begins to love her and have a relationship with her and emotion, feelings for her. It's the exact opposite of Amnon. Mm-hmm. Amnon turns all of that lust, that love, into lust and into hatred. Shechem wants to remain with her, wants to, and therefore he turns to the family. Yaakov and David play a similar role of being silent in the story. Yaakov shemaki timei dina bito v'hecherish. He's silent, as is David. Ubnei Yaakov ba'om min ha'sadeh kishamam. Yaakov's brother, his children came from the field. They were very angry. Yaakov. because this disgrace has been done and this is not done in Israel. It's exactly the same language. And that comparison also begs the distinction, Shechem, at least in as dishonorable as it started, at least wanted to end in an honorable fashion, whereas Amnon has the exact opposite. So she starts. Where was I? Ratomalo al achi, al ta'aneni, ki lo ya'asekim b'Yisrael, al ta'aset ha'nevelah hazot. And then she turns that kind of strong reproach into a sense of the emotions of it. V'ani ana olichet cherpati. Where will I carry my shame? If you do this to me, my shame will haunt me forever. More importantly, this shame will taint you forever. You will be as a disgraced in Israel. You will be shamed. You will destroy your future. How are you going to raise your head in Israel again in the future? You are the future king. Okay, so let's do this. Let's step back from the emotions of it and think rationally for a moment. If you desire me, if you want to have me, then just talk to the king and he won't withhold me. In other words, there's a permissible path forward. And that's what led to our discussion last week about the status of her as a sister, half-sister, stepsister, etc., because she seems to imply that there isn't really an incest issue here. It's just about the relationships between men and women. And so, but as unfortunately is the case in so many instances, and this parak is one of the most graphic prakim in Tanakh, but also an extraordinary insight into the mindset of the perpetrator of these crimes, there's no amount of rationality that is going to tame his passion, refuses to listen to her. He overpowers her. He rapes her. Forced her in labor. And then, Amnon sin agdola mod. Then he takes all of that passion and all of that lust, and in the aftermath of the act that is now filled with the shame and the taint of the chait, he transforms all of that into a searing hatred for her, to the point where he says to her, Kumi lechi, get up, leave. That's a phrase that should also ring in our ears, but it's a much, the association is much further back in terms of our course of study. If you remember the end of the first part of the story, Pelegesh Begiva, where that was also a very graphic story, and we're going to unfortunately have to go back and review it because it's part of what we need to understand. But there too, he says to her after he had thrown her, the Pilegesh, out to the people of the city to have her all night long, and she comes back literally with her hand on the doorknob, half dead, and he says to her, Kumi lech, get up, let's go. And that kind of callous, cold, but in this case, it's Kumi Lechi, leave. Now, in that moment, he's now added insult to injury. Because remember everything we said about David. Why is it so important to David to stay with Bathsheba, to remain married to Bathsheba? Why is he even allowed to remain married to Bathsheba or mandated by the Navi to do so? Because in the aftermath of the act, which was a chait, he now has an obligation to her, which is the Torah obligation, not to send her away. Because if you send her away, her life is done for. She is shamed and can never rebuild her life. She's been with the prince of the king, or in this case, in David's case, with the king. She can't go back to a normal life. Like we compared it to Ahasuerus's harem. One night with the king, and then they go off to the harem of Shashgaz forever. So the Torah demands that in this kind of a case that you take her, marry her, and take responsibility for her. David does so with Bathsheba. That's exactly the aftermath of the story of Bathsheba. Amnon does the exact opposite.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So why does she assume before it happens that that's the way he's going to act? She could assume that, you know, he's going to love her and want to keep her and have her and take her. For what?
Because of the language of the beginning of the story. In other words, when she comes in, he already turns on her violently. But tagesh elav le'chol v'yachazik ba. He grabs her. V'yomer la boy shichvimi. So he attacks her.
Mm-hmm.
In that moment, she turns to him and begs him with this plea of compassion not to do so. He refuses, and so the story of the rape is continued. V'yechazak mimena, he overpowers her. V'yaneh v'yishkavota. But the violence starts first, and then in that moment, she pushes him back, and he overpowers her.
Okay. I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
You had been saying that David couldn't say anything because it's like history repeating itself. But mm-hmm. it isn't, because he married Bathsheba and took care of her. So couldn't he have said to her, said to Amnon, you need to marry this girl?
Yeah, you're assuming
that's kind of what I did.
Well, that's assuming what he said. That's more or less what she says.
No, right. But David could have said that to him afterwards. You know, it's because it's not the same as Bathsheba. He took care of Bathsheba.
Right. Whereas so that's Amnon, what she said. That's exactly what she says. Her response to his, that's exactly what she says. Her response to this declaration, Vayomer la Amnon, kumi lechi, get out. Her response to him now is, Batomelo, al, no, odot hara'ah gdola zot. This evil that you do now is greater, me'acheret asher asita imi l'shacheni. This evil that you do to send me away is worse than what you did before. That's exactly what she says to him.
Couldn't David impress that upon him?
Danon, did you take me forcefully, but now you send me away? Like that's exactly what the Torah warned against. That's exactly what the concern was. That you send me away, my life is over. That's precisely what David didn't do with Bathsheba. And everybody else in the kingdom is saying he should, but it's only the Navi standing with David who says no. But he refused, because Amnon is Amnon and not David.
But that's what I'm saying. Couldn't David impress upon him that this is what he should do? You said David didn't say anything.
David's story is a whole tragedy into itself. David is not saying anything because David is totally non-player in this parable. That's part of the tragedy. Okay, so he sent her away. He told her to leave. She's pushing. She's saying no. She's saying, don't send me away. She's begging. And he's not listening. So he finally calls over his nar. And he says, as Misharet, calls him back in. And he says, Shilchuna et zot me'alai. Get this one away from me. Send this one. She doesn't have a name. She doesn't even have a name. Zot. Shilchuna zot. Get this one away. Send the out. Una'ola delat acharea. And bolt the door behind her. And that's the tragedy. The insult to injury and the salt on the wound, to mix the metaphors, right? The sense of not only does he violate her, but then he sends her away as if callously doesn't care about her. All of that emotional connection is now demonstrated to be nothing more than the lust that he has for her, and an act of passion. And the story is a horrific indictment of Amnon in the end. And I come back to the question with which I began. Yonadav's role in all of this. Did Yonadav anticipate this kind of Amnon? I can't see it. I don't see it in any permutation that Yonadav was described as Yonadav, the nephew of the king, Rea of Amnon, Chacham Od, wise man. Even if he's cunning, he's not evil. Amnon is evil. I just don't see that intent in Amnon's, in Yonadav's initial offer. And so I come back to the suggestion which we've had from the beginning, that Yonadav's intent here was much more innocent and much purer than Amnon's intent. There's already a beginning of a writing on the wall we can see in the language of the request for Tamar to come. Yonadav's plan ends the moment she enters his bedroom. Yonadav's achieved all that he set out to achieve, which was just to bring them together, to create the circumstances for them to be alone, and then to trust Amnon to do the menschlich thing. But that's where his mistake begins, because Amnon is anything but the mensch. And so that story turns violent very quickly. And ultimately then comes back to David and to Avshalom to deal with the aftermath. More or less, that's part one, or that's presentation A, which is quite intense, but places the question of, the question is Yonadav. There's no ambiguity about Amnon, and there's no ambiguity about Avshalom. The ambiguity in the story is about the role of Yonadav. And at least, you know, from this perspective, sort of where I think the Malbim is alluding, Yonadav's intention was innocent, maybe a little naive, but the goal was to orchestrate an opportunity for Amnon and Tamar to have an evening together. Take advantage of the fact that you look ill, pretend you are ill, she'll come bring you dinner, you'll have some chicken soup, and then you'll have a night together, you'll have Shalom Yisrael. And then, of course, that turns into a tragedy of the highest proportion. But, however, okay, so after having presented this whole thing, it's one, I think, loophole or weakness in this presentation, which is that it means that Yonadav, who's described as Ish Chacham Od, doesn't really understand Amnon. Doesn't really understand what he's dealing with. Naive, yes. Foolish, yes. But that's hard to describe as Ish Chacham Od. And so ultimately, this whole presentation hinges on the assumption that as smart as Yonadav is, he is also a little bit in the, let's call it naive context. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. I'm uncomfortable with the suggestion or the implication that a person in Tanakh described as Ish Chacham Od, at the end of the day, is still responsible for setting up what is inherently a horrendous crime. So I come back to the question of whether or not Yonadav truly understood Amnon, and whether or not he is completely as innocent as the text would seem to imply. And is there another way to look at his role and to look at the story? That we're going to have to explore in more detail.
Sometimes
in part two.
Sometimes people are book smart and they're... So smart can mean one thing, but it doesn't mean that you have to give him credit for knowing everything.
Yeah,
we know that's... so little about him. It's It's all guesswork. Are you going to deal with the way the Talmud interprets this story in Sanhedrin?
So a little bit, we dealt with that last week. In other words, the Talmud sees her as a permissible because she's the daughter of Batoar and Yifatoar.
It also talks about she damaged him so that he couldn't.
Yeah, I'm not going to go there. There's no indication to that part of it in the text and in the shot of it. So I think I'm going to.
The Talmud makes a big deal out of it.
I understand. That's the divergence between shot and drash. my goal is to try to understand at least those parts that are related to the pshat of it. That there's no evidence to that piece of it in the text and the pshat. So I think I'm going to, for the sake of the integrity of this recording, I think I'm going to leave that part of the story out for now.
Can I ask another question? And I may be jumping ahead. You let me know. But the way that the text reads that he is a re'eh, is a re'eh not a very... Is that not a very close friend rather than a chaver? I mean, if he is, should he have not known
Noam? Okay. So that just strengthens my question.
Right.
Should he have known? Could he have known? Should he, could he, would he? There's a lot of variables we're never going to have an answer to. What I want to suggest is, and a kind of an indication of where this is going to go next week, is we've been assuming all along that at the crux of the story lies the passion of Amnon for Tamar. And therefore, Yonadab's role in orchestrating that passion. What if the central pivot around which the story revolves is not at all Amnon's passion for Tamar? That's just the circumstances around which the central motif of the story is presented.
Maybe he just wanted to take something away from his brother.
Well, maybe. Maybe there's a tension between Amnon and Avshalom that we're not yet seeing. And maybe that's part of where we need to explore. So that part of the story with Zot Hashem, we will explore in more detail in our continuation of the story. I have to leave you on a cliffhanger, otherwise I wouldn't be doing my job. So that will be our cliffhanger for tonight. And we will continue with Zot Hashem next week. If you're joining us on Monday morning, then next week, Monday morning is at 9:15 a.m. If you're joining us Monday evening, then it is at 7:15 p.m. Central Time, winter time. And all good. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's nice seeing you, Bela.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing, Bela. Nice to see you.
Thank you.